We're a partnership of professionals who give not only of our money, but also of our time and our business acumen to non-for-profits who focus on children at risk and education. We have a dual mission, and that is philanthropy education, and that's what tonight is all about. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to you our moderator, who will introduce our speaker, Dodie Crockett. Dodie was one of the early major energies behind DSVP, and she's been a strong leader ever since. She is a past chair of Dallas Social Venture Partners, and there aren't many people in the city of Dallas who have more knowledge about philanthropy than Dodie Crockett. So please help me in welcoming Dodie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving your evening. I hope that this will be an enjoyable time for you, as I know it will be for me to spend the time talking to Lucy. In 1974, Muhammad Yunus, a professor of economics in Dhaka, Bangladesh, found that he could not teach the elegant theories of economics while he was surrounded by the poor and a famine going on in Bangladesh at the time. So he challenged himself and his students to use the neighboring village as a living classroom. In that community, Yunus discovered 42 women who were weaving bamboo stools. He decided to loan those 42 women the equivalent of 27 US dollars, and with that gave them economic self-sufficiency and a chance to control their own destiny. From that seed loan grew the Grameen Project and eventually the Grameen Bank. It was founded in 1983 based on the principles that they had and the experience that they had had in rural Bangladesh. Since that time, and this time I have to look at my notes, they've made cumulative loans of over $6 billion to 7 million poor. The repayment rate is 98%, and 97% of the people given loans are women. The smallest loan is the equivalent of $12. Replications of their program now appear all over the world. In 2003, our own Lucy Billingsley heard Alex Counts, who's the CEO of the Grameen Foundation USA, talk about the power of microcredit all around the world. Now, those of you who already know Lucy would know that true to form, Lucy then began to research this until she felt like she truly had found a business-centered solution to poverty. So she did another thing she does really well. She gathered 30 women who flew with her to Chiapas, Mexico, which is essentially the poorest state in Mexico, to look at this in action. Those women came back and inspired, founded the Chiapas Project. They personally pledged and raised $780,000 in support of the microfinance institution there. And Lucy now serves on the board of the Grameen Foundation USA. Welcome, Lucy. Thank you so much to be our honored guest tonight. I think it's kind of an understatement to say that the Billingsley name in Dallas is associated with multi-million dollar real estate projects. I know that you spent, 15 years with the Dallas Market Center, took them through three huge expansions. And now we have the Billingsley Company to thank for the beautiful One Arts Plaza Urban Center next to the Arts District. What would possess someone who's used to dealing in millions to begin a project that deals with loans of $50?
Well, first off, obviously it's great fun to be here and, to be, introduced as a guest or a speaker is a little unnerving, but it's a thrill to get to visit about microfinance and life. So to jump into the answer to your question, I used to think I was unusual. You know, I used to think, oh, I'm going to be different. You know, we do as a teenager to distinguish ourselves and in life. And I've now really realized I'm Exhibit A. I am the 50-year-old female grown in Dallas who's gone to work. And that life experience is a treasured and great one, but it's also one that yearns for purpose, as we all do. And you love everything you do about your work, and you invest yourself into your work, and you seek, and we all seek purpose in our work. And yet then somehow we wonder what is there in life beyond. And I think we also wonder, what is this human experience? You know, not only why are we here, but what is the difference in someone who lives on less than $1 a day and us? I'm giving you too long an answer.
No, please.
But it's this kind of wondering. I used to look at the things on television, and I don't know if it's a UNICEF commercial or March of Dimes or whatever it is, and you see these people in these circumstances that are beyond comprehension. I can't really imagine myself there. And so what I would do is shut myself down emotionally, because that's too wrenching, and think things like, well, they can't do what I can do. They're just different. And yet, then I went to meet some of these women. What would I do if I had to raise my children on less than $1 a day? Well, first off, I would steal, I would cheat, I would lie. I would do whatever it took. And you see these women, and they don't. And actually, they are raising their children on less than $1 a day. So they are innately entrepreneurs. They are innately community-based. They are survivors. They have talents and skills that I have never had. And so part of this is my own seeking, what is our life experience about? Who are these people? What is the power of a human? And then, it goes, keep on talking and talking. I mean, it goes on into what is the best way that I can engage and give and involve and all of that.
Well, then let's begin at the beginning, which is a definition.
Okay.
What is microcredit and microfinance? What is that? What is that principle?
It's really simple. It is giving a loan of obviously infinitesimally small dollars to someone to permit themselves to launch their own job, their own career, their own business. And this person who's never been trusted with any financial opportunity has, first off, the chance of a lifetime. And you would think, they can't pay back a loan. They're going to have to take it for food. But they do. Mm-hmm. And so microcredit is the lending of the money. And then also within the Grameen Foundation, it is a construct. It is a process. And it is a process where the loan is not just given to one person, but it is a group of, a community is approached. And the loan is given to each individual, but in groups of five. And so if I'm going to take a loan, I'm going to go get four other people I trust. Mm-hmm. We're each going to be given our own loan, and yet, if I miss a payment, you other four aren't going to get any more money until I've made my payments. So it is a version of a group indemnity. Mm-hmm. And it is that system that brings these groups together five at a time to then deliver the repayments and to support each other. So it's both the loan itself and then this whole process of creating the microfinance nonprofit banks. Mm-hmm.
Well, given the current news and events, this next statement might raise a few eyebrows, but one belief of Muhammad Yunus is that access to credit is a fundamental human right. Can you share your own thoughts on that? Well, it's a shocker for this week, isn't it?
Yeah. But again, what have we as humans created as the currency of life? this credit, this thing, is how we connect with each other with all of the give and take. And to permit someone not to engage in the currency of life, how do we have the right to do that? It is an arrogance that of me looking at that television ad and reacting as I have, and I'm sure I will again in the future. And it's an arrogance of ours to say that that person doesn't have the right. Mm-hmm. We created the system.
We did. Well, you started to, but I want you to really take us through an example of how these loans are made. You know, give us a story or two of maybe even someone in the project in Chiapas, sure, where they got their group of five together, and what did they take that loan for? And how long did it take to pay it back? And what is the, build that community
what
for
that
us.
What that little experience is. Well, the first loan is, and now the when you said the $27, that was $27
for
42 people.
Right.
Now, the first, you just can't believe it. The first loan now on average is about $50. And it's a loan for 6 months. And a loan has to be paid back with interest. And the interest rate's about 38%. And that's a good deal. And that's defensible. And I'll answer in chat about that because, of course, our immediate reaction is that's outrageous. What the woman does with the loan, she makes weekly payments of interest and principal, and she also can have savings and can have insurance. Mm-hmm. But what she does is what she knows. What did her mother teach her? To sew, to cook, to trade, to sell. And so you will have women in obviously in Chiapas, Mexico, you'll have many women doing weaving and stitching and sewing. You'll have women, you've driven in Mexico and seen the chickens, you know, that have just been cut on the side of the road. You know, I've seen the chicken before and after now. And the meat out there is really fresh. So you have that. One lady got coal from the mountains. She lives right on the edge of town. And then she would trade it and bring the coal in for people in town. So what do people do and what do they become? I think it's the same thing with us. What do we do with what we have? What can we become? The one lady named Luisa had seven children. Two had passed away and her husband passed away. It was really gracious of him to do so. He was an alcoholic and abusive and very difficult in this relationship. And so she had a loan, and all of the kids got, she had a loan where she was selling Coca-Colas to people who had walked down this road. And Coca-Cola means pouring it in a plastic cup, and you couldn't tell really that it was a road, but obviously this was an intersection, a crossroads. And then all of the kids in the family got sick. And she took the money to give to the medicine man because they had to be well. And he bought Coca-Colas and because it's holy water and the flowers and the eggs and prayed over them. And she was scared to take out another loan then. And finally was encouraged and urged and she took out a $25 loan because she didn't want to expose herself too much. And then she bought a sheep. So her life was very modest. Then there's Andrea. And she took her first loan and her second loan and her third loan, and she has an orchard and she has pigs and sheep and she has a masa grinding machine, and her last loan was for $1,800 and she's got a truck because the husband can drive the tortillas into town, and you know she is an entrepreneur.
She's an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yes. And so you have every story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to toss out one other story.
Please.
You know, I like short answers. I'm sorry. So I'm not doing this well. But in Bangladesh, recently, every step of the way, Muhammad Yunus has been challenged. How can you loan to a woman? And on it goes. In every step of the way. And recently, maybe this was a year and a half ago, I heard this story. They were saying, okay, so you can take care of women and you can take care of poor. Fine. But that's not much now. It used to be, you know, impossible, but now we've got that one down. What about the beggars? Mm-hmm. Oh, what about that woman on the side of the road that's an invalid? What can you do for the beggars? And first off, there's the beggars that weren't invalids. And each loan officer in Bangladesh said, okay, I will take one beggar. And they were scared of this concept of losing the money and the repayments. And they gave the money to the beggar and said, before you go door to door to beg for rice as you do, buy something to sell. And so the beggars became door-to-door salesmen. Mm-hmm. And it was hugely successful. So then they said, okay, go for the invalids. And the invalids keep fruit next to them. And mm-hmm. so instead of begging, they're selling fruit. Mm-hmm. So the human dignity, all we're doing is permitting people to reach for who they can be. Mm-hmm. So the stories are overwhelming.
I love that story because, you know, that I think the beggars group now in Bangladesh, have they made loans to 80,000 beggars. 80,000 have been adopted by the bank.
Yeah, yeah.
And 5,000 of them have ceased begging completely, you know, but have found other ways to become members of the Grameen Bank. And they wear the badge of the Grameen Bank on the street to let people know that they are proud members. And the Grameen Bank there is also 95% owned by the people who borrow from it. Only 5% of it is now owned by the government. So I know that the methods that have really, you know, if you would like to read a fantastic book, read Banker to the Poor mm-hmm. by Muhammad Yunus. That is the sort of the textbook of this and all the things he went through.
Right.
So one of my questions was, there have been modifications to the way the system has worked, you know, for different cultures, has mm-hmm. there been any modification of that in the Chiapas Project, or are they able to pretty much follow the 5-member team for the Grameen style loan for microloan?
What the Chiapas Project has become is really we're a fundraising arm in Dallas, and what we have done is adopted first the state mm-hmm. of Chiapas, but then a program from Grameen Foundation, which is to raise $10 million for 7 countries in Latin America. And our goal is 3.5 of that. And the focus is to get 186,000 women new loans. So that's the model. So what we as the Chiapas Project have done is become fundraisers. In this area, though, the Grameen Foundation has then found these microfinance institutions, and these institutions agree with the Grameen principles and will modify them, but follow them by and large. But there are other models out there that are, you know, beyond the Grameen model. Mm-hmm. The microfinance has started off as a movement and is becoming an industry. So there's lots and lots and lots of changes.
And experimentation that's going on.
Yeah.
Well, why did you select Chiapas? I mean, I would say that many people in here had heard of Chiapas because of their civil unrest over the last decade.
Right.
So why did you gather 30 women and fly to Chiapas? What prompted you?
You know, when I talked with Alex, I am one of the least philanthropic people in town. And I've always said, if you see me give to a cause, I've got the problem. So, but when I talked with Alex and, you know, he explained the principles of this to me, what I wanted to do is see, is would we care? Would Dallasites care? And if we would, then where would we care that would have multiple benefits to us? And obviously, going to Mexico and enriching lives in Mexico will have a neighborly mm-hmm. impact and other impacts with us. So then we just asked for him, what's the best program that could be a, mm-hmm. a relationship program, and went there. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously now we're growing beyond that, but it was to have good connections and relationships for those of us in Dallas. And so many of us come from the Latin American countries.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think one of the most interesting facets of microfinance, microcredit, is the obviously almost ridiculously high percentage of loans that go to women.
Right.
And, you know, I looked at those 97%, 98% numbers, but I think that they found tremendous success with women, and I'd love for you to talk about the history of that and why it's so successful with women.
You know, it's a fascinating thing for me. But first off, it's clear that women are the underutilized asset. So in any society, if you can grab your greatest potential and leverage it, that's incredibly meaningful. So that's been that's a big part of the first opportunity. Then you end up saying, well, you've got so many cultures, and women are treated so differently across the world that certainly there are cultures where this won't work, and certainly there are cultures where women won't make repayments, and then how do they spend their money? And the answer is, any place that has permitted microfinance to come, you do have to either get in under the governmental radar, so the society has to permit it, or within the government permission. And it's not like it's a big thing that has to have any legal authority, but you just it's those two methods. Every place it has gone, it has been successful. Whoever has welcomed microfinance in, and let me say, it is a major program in Pakistan. It is deep into India. So these are Islamic areas. So it's not just, so every place it has really been accepted, though, it has been successful. And then the amazing thing to me that I had no idea was that when women get money, we do spend it differently than men. And when you pull us back to our roots, and not when we're just out shopping and we have wealth, but when you pull us back to our roots, we cannot help ourselves. We are not better in any way, but we are hard, this is my, obviously this is, everything's my opinion, we are hardwired for our kids. And if I had nothing but an opportunity or a dollar, it of course would go to my child. And so when women have nothing but their first profits, they're feeding their children better. You have to put your children into schools to be a part of the program. You're clothing your children better. And so the expenditure by a woman into society is much richer social impact than a man. A man's instincts are just different. And it's just, it does not matter the ethnicity or the region of the world. It really is just a difference. So I found, you know, one more, this is sort of who we are.
Yeah. In looking at the website for the Chiapas Project and reading about this, I thought that was very fascinating, that it was all about how women reinvest the money they get back into their children, and then secondarily into their home. So, you know, those of us who are hardwired for decorating, it's true. It's just true. We're going to get beds, we're going to put the roof on, we're going to do those things that would create a home after our children are fed. And that is, and that is, they feel like one of the great successes of this, because they, if they don't pay it back, they can't get another one. This is the opportunity that they have, and that they know that.
And, you know, one of the giant impacts is not just this, where do you spend your money, but you can imagine being a child in a home where your mother is totally discounted, obviously has no value. And then she goes to get this loan. Well, her husband first says, ha, my wife, don't loan her any money. And then she gets the loan, and he says, well, they're not going to get that money back. And then she makes a payment, and he's pretty stunned, and then she repays her loan, and then she doubles her money, because the second loan is double the first. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, my wife, she's bringing some money in. And then the children see their mother go from work and grind to hope and opportunity. And through her eyes and her vision, there's changes. And so there's a tremendous impact on the world outlook for these kids.
In looking at the Grameen Foundation annual report, one of the things they track year by year is the top 25 uses of a loan. And last year, for the first time, number 11 was a loan for higher education. And that was, and so this is how far along this program has come in Bangladesh, that they are now, those mothers who built up these businesses are now coming back, and they're taking loans for their children to go to college. So it is kind of a remarkable sort of pyramid that they can build on with very small start. What is the most unusual loan you can remember? I just thought I'd throw one out there.
I don't know.
I just saw that list and thought, okay, Milk Cow is number one for 20 years. Yeah. It's like the top 20. Milk Cow was still number one.
And, well, you know, one thing that fascinated me was a woman who's selling vitamins and, you know, moving into that. And there's a fellow named Chuck Slaughter who had that Travel Smith catalog and sold that. And he's launching micro-franchising. And what he's doing is selling, he'll give you the money to go buy this basket of mosquito nets and medicines and all. And then you become that, you know, you become the Eckerds.
The
drugstore for your area. And I think that, there's some innovations that are breaking through that are quite exciting.
Yeah, well, I think one of their most famous loans is for the phone, that they call the phone lady. The woman in the village with the cell phone.
That's right.
And that's what you usually see if you really start to look into this. Well, I know that the Chiapas Project actually funds the local microfinance organization there. And I wondered if you, it seems to me that there may be a lot of credibility with the local people there because it's administrated locally.
Absolutely.
Do you might maybe talk about that? We're not coming, you're not coming in there and saying the Americans are coming in and we're doing this project.
Right. I mean, absolutely. We're just a hidden funding source. It is all local. The only thing that's not local would be the money, and their money comes from a variety of sources, not just us. And then Grameen Foundation, the U.S. organization, was founded to take these best practices of the bank worldwide. And so the Grameen Foundation will come in and help train the executives or the management of the bank and put in software systems and finance systems and accounting systems and best practices and sharing collaborative information. They now have a PPI, Poverty Progress Index. Can't get that one out. Peter Piper. And this is another tool for measuring what is poverty and what are the real advancements.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just opened my next question, which is I'd love for you to talk about some of the goals of the Grameen Foundation USA, because there are microfinance and microcredit programs, even locally in Dallas and in the United States. Would you talk about a little bit about that work in the States?
First off, I'm going to just mention that the Grameen name is used so many ways.
Right.
And there are lots of different entities. There's a Grameen spinoffs is what they are, but there's one for education and whatnot. So Grameen Foundation USA is actually launched to take help raise money in the United States and take it all across the world. So that's the group that I'm engaged in. But there's also, and I think you're really asking about, I don't know if it's called Grameen USA, but it's something
named that Grameen is Grameen USA. That's what I meant to say, yes.
And that's just launched, and the focus there is microfinance in the United States. And how might it be launched? And there's a program, a very small one in Dallas, Plan Fund, Project Enterprise in New York City, another one in San Diego. And it's much more complicated in the United States. First off, it's harder to make money. It's harder to launch a business. And then we got a lot of social networks. So if you don't like it, you can walk alone and you can get it. So it's much more expensive and complicated. So, but their interest and focus is to really help the United States adopt. It'd be much more micro-enterprise because it's complicated.
Well, I just, it was interesting because you read most about this, that it's mostly for developing nations. Right. But there are methods of doing this that are right in our own backyard, which I always think is fun.
Well, I'm going to jump in real quickly and say Ascension.
Please. Yes.
Not Grameen, but Ascension is, there's one a group called Ascension Texas, and they've just arranged a business transaction with Citicorp for a $30 million loan to be a source of lending for them into Texas, and I think they're in about seven or eight locations. So microfinance is going mainstream.
Right. That's it. Microfinance on Main Street. Right. That'll be there. Well, one of the most important aspects of Dallas Social Venture Partners for us is we're interested in social investing and to measure our outcomes. That's right. One of the things for social return.
Right.
And, of course, being able to measure, you know, that you have, you know, 98%, you know, repayment rate, which especially today would be the envy of any bank in the world. But, you know, that's really not the whole story. You know, how do you measure success of your personal investment in this venture? And what keeps you excited?
My measurement really is watching Grameen's results. Mm-hmm. And that you've got the financial results, mm-hmm. but that's not it at all.
Right.
The results are how many people are getting new loans and how many people are coming out of poverty and what's the definition of poverty. So what's the change in lifestyle? And the results are overwhelming, not just as we've said on these statistics, but for instance, there's an instrument that the Grameen Bank has, I mean Grameen Foundation, the U.S. guys, that we have. It's called Grameen Growth Guarantee. Mm-hmm. And I can take, the first raise was $31 million. So you could participate in that by having $1 million in your bank, and it's your money, and you're getting the interest off of it. But what you've done is said to Grameen, this is a guarantee. And Grameen takes this guarantee and goes around the world with $31 million of guarantees, and they get a local microfinance institution, and they say, I'll give you a $200,000 guarantee. Now let's go to your bank, and you go get an $800,000 loan. Over and over, this money's going around the world. So let's say $31 million is now given loans of $120 million, no more than 10% in any one country, you know, a lesser percent with any one entity, and my money's sitting at the bank. And so my risk is that there's a tsunami someplace. And then that one entity, I might have taken a 5% hit. Or there's a governmental change. So the measurement of results is the wave of that is fantastic. So we're getting... The loans are significant in that initial gift in dollar, but these other financial instruments are quite intriguing.
So what you're telling us is that the interesting thing for you is also about the leverage of these commitments of people, that it's not necessarily giving your money. It's actually giving the use of your money.
Yeah, it's giving them the right to borrow it.
So... And so that's what I think we were talking about, sort of the new ways that people are finding to extend microfinance around the world. Well, I think one of the things we always want to know is how, you know, we're sort of a action group here. And how can we help? How can we help the Chiapas Project? What are the ways throughout the system that someone here that was interested in this could be involved? So start with Chiapas.
Well, Chiapas and the Grameen Foundation will blend together pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. They're almost mirrored answers. First off, this is a business of currency. Mm-hmm. So the more money we can get into a microfinance institution, the better. And to make a commercial break, when a microfinance institution gets to 12,000 borrowers, they're at break even, so they're self-sustaining.
Right.
So you don't have to give them any more money unless you want to leverage their growth. So the first thing, and you know, it's almost like real estate. If the answer is location, 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 in microfinance, it's money, money, money. but then in Dallas, obviously, we want to engage more people and do that as vehicles to raise money. And then we've got another program that's called Recycling to Eradicate Poverty. And the fellow who runs this program's UNT, and he's just been acknowledged by the Gates Foundation as a young philanthropist, strategic. I don't know the exact title, but it was quite exciting.
Something good.
Yeah, something very good and exciting for him. And this is recycling of inkjet cartridges and cell phones And by turning them in, then they're recycled, but then a donation is made to the Chiapas Project. And the third one really is leveraged by the Grameen Foundation, but it's called Bankers Without Borders. And it's a new program to really get volunteers out and active and into the field. So if, for instance, in Bolivia, they have a need for someone to help come with the accounting for 2 weeks, it would be going and engaging in that kind of way. So it's sort of matching skill sets to the businesses, not to the women themselves, not at this stage, but to the businesses of running the microfinance institutions.
Great, wonderful. Well, I know we want to have the opportunity to let our audience join us in this conversation, because there's probably a million questions that I would not have answered or asked. So would you think about a question? And if you have one, I'm going to stand up so I can see. And one of the things we're going to be doing is we are podcasting this. And since we don't have a microphone for you, I'd like you to speak up so I can hear you, and then I'm going to try to repeat your question into my microphone so that it can go for the podcast. So, questions. Yes, Lisa. And she, you asked the question about the 38% interest rate, and would you mind going into that a little bit more?
Thank you, because that's important to go into. I think you have to imagine, if you were in a small town and had thousands of borrowers spread out over the hillsides that each had a $50 or more loan, and you had to go meet with each one of them every week and collect in person their payments of interest and principal and account for those payments, the process is very labor intensive. And so at a 38% rate, and it varies for the different institutions, and I'm talking rural. In urban settings, it's not quite as hard, so the rates could be a little less. But at that kind of rate, it takes you to have up to about 12,000 borrowers before you're self-sustaining. After that time, let's say you're moving towards 13, you could say, oh, should I drop the rate? And that's the same thing as saying, well, should I quit growing? And so it seems that when some entities get to hundreds of thousands of borrowers, clearly they change their rate structure. And then they're also able to borrow from banks, and things are able to change. But in these early stages, it's clearly at that kind of level, and I've never heard of it being less than 20. But I might not be the best informed person either.
The interesting discussion I didn't go into at the beginning was when Muhammad Yunus found the 42 women that were making the bamboo stools, they were borrowing money from the local money lender to buy their bamboo every day. And in exchange for that, he had control of the production, of what they had to sell the stools to him for whatever price he set. And so when you calculated what the interest rate was, it was something like, 180% a day, relative to the work that relative to their labor. And so his original loan of $27 to all 42 of them was so that they could control their own pricing. By controlling their own product, they were able to control that. So what you really have in many of these areas is this is coming in and replacing sort of a 38% to us, sounds usurious, but it's replacing something that is far off the scale from anything we could ever imagine, because capital is so scarce there. So thank you for that. I think you're right. I think 20% is pretty much the standard for a developed bank that has significant depositors and everything. Mm-hmm. So 38%, I was thinking, was pretty reasonable said that. So next question, Mr. Poulter. Sorry. Okay, the question was, looking at five person structure that's the traditional Grameen model. What are some of the other models that have worked?
There's a wonderful story that I've been told of in Haiti without any banks, and I think this model's been established elsewhere in the world too, that just a group of women will come together and they will all put in, let's say, a dollar, and then they have $20 or $30, and each month one of them will get it, and then they can go do whatever they might, and then they bring their monies obviously back to, for the next. And so there's creative models like that that have been launched by women, but they haven't grown to scale really. I also believe now in India that some of the models are moving from the group loan to individual loans. And I know one organization, SKS, has studied, and maybe they're implementing, getting people to make payments off of a credit card. So, you know, then you're really getting into an individual loan.
So there are a lot of ways to do this. In fact, one of the, we talked about the beggar's loan.
Yeah.
And those are not in groups.
Right.
Those are individual loans. But remember, you said one individual banker will take on one individual beggar.
Right.
And so that was the way they started it. But they didn't force them to be in groups. They looked at the problem and then tried to address it. So I think that what, you know, I think the method is to be creative in the moment. Yeah. To try to find that creative solution. I think there was someone. Yes.
Actually, I had a question related to the interest rate. Has there ever been any issue in a Muslim society regarding charging interest? Because I think that's not acceptable under Islamic law.
You want to take that one?
Or
you want,
the answer is yes and yes. Now, how did they skin that cat? I'm not sure.
Well, let me take a stab at it.
Do it.
Well, of course, Bangladesh is mostly a Muslim country, and this is where the Grameen Bank flourished to begin with. And it's very difficult in two ways. One, for men to even talk to women who are not allowed to, you know, to talk, so that the bankers would originally, the students who were Muhammad Yunus's students, would stand outside the hut, and the women would gather inside, and they would explain to them the whole process of this. Well, in many cases, the local imam would say, well, you know, you're going, you know, straight away if you do this, if you, and but ultimately, the way that they essentially got it approved, and frankly, it's approved by the clerics all over Bangladesh, is one key factor is that they are investing back in themselves. They own 95% of this bank. So they're really just borrowing from themselves and paying it back to help other people. So it to them, they began to look at it as a circular giving, because their interest went to pay to help another person in their group. So once they understood that, the local clerics not only sort of supported it, they began to come and bless the groups according to, you know, that this is going to be a group that it will be blessed. So, you know, there definitely are ways out there that they've been very creative.
Yeah,
I just thought that was a very interesting one.
Oh,
so,
I love the story.
Another question. Yes, Ms. Makoviak.
The question is, there's a requirement of putting the children in school, and are there other requirements? And the answer is yes. Each group gets to really sort of agree on what their own rules are, but there's a group of about 8 to 10 that are pretty repetitive. It's a clean home. It's understanding health and water and trying to get to provide that as best you can in your environment for your family. And then it is making every week you have to be at the meeting to make your repayment, and you have to make your payments, and then the education. Besides that, I think the others become more what does that group want to adopt as part of the rules.
Mm-hmm. Great. Wonderful. Yes.
It's such a pleasure to hear you speak, first of all, but I'm really curious if, to your knowledge, the Grameen Foundation or any of institutes have studied whether there are key features of the culture or the economic landscape that correlate with outcomes. You know, are there certain aspects of the financial landscape? You know, they're a long way away from a market center and are isolated, or key characteristics of the culture, like highly immobile, many generations living in the same. Has a quantitative look been taken as to what might be predictive for success?
I'm going to try to repeat that for our listeners. But it was actually a very good question, because it is a good question. Are there specific things that are cultural or geographic that have been studied to determine if they are more successful because of these variables? Is that a very quick version of that?
Clearly, there are geographic issues. And for instance, the Grameen Foundation, as they try to go around the world, we don't go to urban centers because urban centers can be readily serviced. So that's part of the bias. The mission of the Grameen Foundation is to serve the poorest of the poor, and the poorest of the poor would be rural. Then how rural? And we've really realized that the agricultural society of the poor, which is giant, has not been brought into microfinance deeply. And so that's the biggest single thing that I think I could mention as a known factor. Other than that, honestly, I've not heard of cultural barriers. A government can step in and make things hard. Or a politician can go in and say, I need to be reelected and I'm going to give money to the poor and destroy the integrity of a system. The main thing is accessibility. And if you're in such a small village, it is you've got to have some way to get out a little bit and to have interaction with other villages. So remoteness would be an issue.
Great answer. Yes, Mr. Strauss.
Good thing no politician in this country would offer to give money to the poor, so that's we don't have that problem here. But you touched on two things there. You think of China, it's got a coastal region that's getting wealthy and connected to the world, and then their interior is very rural, very poor. And yet you've also got this history of a communist structure in there for a long time. Is the Grameen successful in a rural environment that's got a central control history like that?
And the question is, using an example of China, has the Grameen model been successful in a country that has a lot of rural population but a central control, like a communist control?
China's a great example. We have been working with China, let me say, for 6 years, and or thereabouts, and had such tough time breaking through. And the reason was because the Chinese government would not permit the 36% or 34 or 38% interest rate. They said, we won't let you charge an interest rate higher than, let me say, 10%. And so these entities could not get traction and grow. Mm-hmm. So the central policy was devastating. That actually changed this past year. And so now the movement into China is strong. And I mean, obviously that is a population that is very entrepreneurial and it's biased. Mm-hmm. So the expectation of impact there is quite significant now. Big opportunity.
You know, I think one of the interesting things about the expansion of the whole Grameen model around the world, because at almost every turn, they were told, first of all, well, it's kind of a cult of personality. If Muhammad Yunus isn't there, it can't expand. Or, no, it has to be in this kind of area, or it can't expand. And over again, the proof was in the pudding. Right. They proved it by taking it to country after country after country. And I'm sort of smiling because I think China has finally realized well, we may as well do this. It's working everywhere else. And it's, you know, they are interested in seeing what will happen there now. And it is really accepted. It is gained greater and greater acceptance, but of course through its own success. So, more questions? Yes, right here on the front.
You had mentioned that there are some other Latin American countries that were on deck. Do you know which other countries?
Oh, great. Well, we're actually, the other Latin American countries that we're involved in are Bolivia, Honduras, Guatemala, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and I forgot somebody. and then Mexico. Brazil is clearly needs to be on deck. That's the other major market to get much deeper in. And Paraguay and Peru, actually. The Consul General for Paraguay in Dallas has launched the Recycling to Eradicate Poverty Program, and he has gotten the entire Paraguayan government behind this. And there's a group called Grameen Trust that goes to countries that have no microfinance at all and sets it up. And we've been working for about 2 years, and Grameen Trust has done their entire study, and they're ready to launch in Paraguay. There's quite a bit of microfinance in Peru, and we've been doing the growth guarantee programs to leverage the existing programs in Peru.
Great. Yes.
Excuse me. Speaking of Honduras, we've been trying to do microloans there for a number of years, specifically with women. And what we're finding is there's such a culture of corruption in the country that instead of putting these women on the path to success, we're making them targets of crime. And because they are almost exclusively single women, because the concept of family doesn't really exist, it's just men going from woman to woman and having 8 to 10 to 12 kids.
Right.
The unintended consequence has been they're being robbed and worse. And I'm wondering, have y'all had success encountering that kind of culture? I know that it takes creativity, but I don't, you know, for 2,000 miles away, I'm not really sure what all we can do on the ground to protect these women we're trying to help.
Let me try to summarize that. We have an audience member who has been attempting microcredit in Honduras and has found that instead of creating more economic opportunity for the women, it has made them the target of other crimes because they, I guess, have money now. And what kind of creative solutions might the Grameen Foundation have tried or offered in that area?
First off, I'm going to say Dominican Republic.
okay.
But now let me be very serious. There are microfinance is not a panacea, and I'm really glad you brought up a problem because though I haven't experienced and heard of this that you're exactly referring to, so I don't have a good answer for you. Clearly, there are problems. I'll give you the flip side of the circumstance that. You've mentioned not to avoid it because I just don't know the answer. But in one of the organizations in Africa, the leader of the microfinance organization was speaking in the United States, and he said, well, you know, it's very difficult for many of these women. They may not be married but have children, and they will have sexual relationships with one man to afford a home and with another man to afford education for their children and another man to afford clothing. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I exaggerate. But that's the picture that was painted to me. And by a woman getting a loan on her own, she starts to free herself from that kind of circumstance. I have heard of loan officers going to collect money and having been attacked or killed so I have heard of that. So it'd be good just to see if there's any other information afterwards visit about. I've also heard the story of a woman whose husband was beating her, and all the other women decided to go to her husband and say, there's a rule in microfinance organization, your wife won't get another loan if she's beaten anymore. That helped.
Wow, for a minute I thought
Can
you were going to say
women?
They took the law into their own hands, and God, but where is this going?
Okay. It's just women are connivers and
well,
good at it.
Yeah, okay. So. Next, another question. Yes, Ms. Lee.
I know your
you're saying that it's not like the U.S. swoops in with money and funds these things, right. But aren't we getting any credit for doing something good in these situations? There's so many things that we get demerits right. for. I was wondering right. if we're getting some good points.
We are clearly, the Grameen Foundation is clearly under the governmental, well, we're not acting as a governmental entity. So, but the leaders of these microfinance institutions around the world are incredibly grateful. There is just a Latin American conference where we brought these different leaders together. And to, you know, first off, anytime you get to commiserate with peers and understand problems and leverage ideas and stimulation is powerful. But then all of this training. So actually the Grameen Foundation is really going through a strategic plan right now to redefine ourselves and to say, what is it that will make the greatest impact on poverty in the future? And so leveraging these organizations in every way, maybe we're going to be the investment bankers for these organizations to help them become significant. That is very, very well regarded. And like the Paraguayan government, when this fellow left from Grameen Trust, he just said he'd never gotten that kind of treatment. And but I'll hesitate and caveat my answer with Grameen Foundation isn't necessarily thought of as Grameen Foundation every USA, you know. So I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. The question I just want to point out was whether or not we're getting points. Oh. As Americans, for this work, and yeah. I think, and of course, that was actually tagged into a question that I'd asked earlier. Where you know you're funding this, but you're having it administrated by local yeah. people, and there is an element I believe in that of trust that we're not coming in and doing it. We're actually regarding them and giving them that you know respect, but they're also giving them the training, the best practices, and the backing, and you know. Hopefully, we're less ugly Americans in those right, in right. those situations. Right. Next, yes.
In these rural areas, I'm curious to know what type of education process you go through when a borrower either walks in the door or you go find them. Do they understand the concept of interest, mm-hmm. principal and interest payments?
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
complex
yeah.
for mm-hmm. somebody living in those types of circumstances.
And the question is, in a rural circumstance, how do you find the people that will take these loans, and how knowledgeable are they of lending practices? How much training do you have to do?
It's interesting if you're going to a community for the first time, and they haven't heard of the loans. That you know, if they've heard of the loans, it's a totally different thing. But then it's garnering credibility. And it's going over and over again to visit with these women and to explain it. And to have them see you repeatedly breeds trust. And then once they are launching their businesses, I think they understand the concept of the cost of money. And yet, I was with a group of women and they had all this merchandise that they'd made up in the mountains of Chiapas that they're going to send down to Cancun to sell, and each different woman had made different things, and you think, oh my gosh, now how is this going to happen? Well, then you looked at the item, and they had a sticker for you and a sticker for me. I mean, they just were so beautifully organized. It was all manual, but it was really great. I met another lady, had two children, and I thought, well, these children, you know, they're hardly, and the older one was too old to have started the school, the younger one was. I got some colors and I'm writing her name out and thinking I'm going to help. And then we go in to see some of the woven belts and things like that. And this girl is doing math in her head like crazy. And so, you know, shame on me once again.
Yeah.
So they don't know how much they the cost per good is. They're not doing cost accounting. But they know if they made more money than they it cost. I mean, they've
right.
got the, and obviously some of them could easily be getting into the cost of goods.
Great. Wonderful. Another question. Yes.
There's kind of two schools of thought that I think are emerging as far as microfinance. One is like philanthropic and one is for profit. And
right.
I think they both have advantages. Could you give your position on that?
The question is, the two types of microfinance are philanthropic and for-profit, and if you could discuss maybe the difference between those two.
That is a huge, huge question in today's changing industry of microfinance. And I think it's a wonderful thing that you have for-profit microfinance, because that means that is here to stay. And this is mainstream and it's part of society. Now, there are cautions that come with it. It is already seen. In fact, one of the organizations, 80% interest rate on for-profit microfinance in urban environments. I think that's safe to say that that's egregious and unnecessary. And so the for-profit, mm-hmm. those of us in nonprofit worry about the social integrity of those doing it on a for-profit basis. I personally don't think that that's going to be something we're going to be able to control. And so we have to be very judicious in our engagement with organizations to ensure that they carry first the mantle of permitting people to lift themselves out of poverty. Articles flying, and governments might end up weighing in on this. Maybe that's where it could really be controlled in the future. Huge issue.
And when you really think about it, the Grameen Bank itself is now a huge for-profit kind of entity. They've turned that bank, it's extremely profitable, but they just use all their profits for the good of the people that own it, which is 95% owned by the partners. Well, we've sort of come to the end of our time, but I have one more question that I want to ask Lucy, and it is this. In 2006, Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And I was personally absolutely elated at that moment. But it gave me a little pause and said, well, this is a man and an economist and a banking institution that have essentially alleviated poverty for millions of people over 30 years. You'd have thought he'd have won for economics because he came up with a new economic system. Yet they won for peace. And I wonder if you would like to give us your closing thoughts on poverty and peace.
Well, that's so eloquently put. I come back to, what's the currency of humanity? And what's the source? If you went to issues across the world, if it's health, endemic situations, if it is terrorism, civil unrest, where does it start? And it starts in the discounting of mankind. And it starts in the having no opportunity and no hope and no education. And if you can give someone enough respect to rise up and succeed and become what they might, it seems to me that you've offered the world the greatest hope for peace.
Thank you so much. This has been a total joy.
Thank you very much. You know so much. I am overwhelmed.
Bryce, can we give it to you?
You know, I think I should just say goodnight and leave it at that. Lucy, we want to thank you, not only for your inspiring story tonight, but for all the really exciting work that you do. Dodi, I want to thank you for keeping this conversation going and help us tell the story. We'd also like to thank Dodi and her husband, Billy Crockett. They're making a contribution to the Chiapas Project in DSVP's name in honor of our speaker. And I'd like
You're
to
welcome.
Thank the Dallas Foundation for their continuing support for our education series. Now, you've just listened to a story about the Chiapas program that at its heart is about leverage. It's about putting together little bits of money with a lot of smart thinking and levering that at just the right moment to cause great social change. Does that sound like anybody you know? Dallas Social Venture Partners follows a very similar model. What we like to do is take a little bit of money, put it together with a lot of talent, the everyday talent that you've gained in your natural life, and invest it in places where we can cause a lot of change. We like to raise up institutions, nonprofits, build their capacity, increase their output, and then start all over again. Now, we like to say doing good better. What we mean is we like to help those who are doing good in their communities do it better. You know the story of you give a man a fish and you feed him for a day? You teach him to fish and you feed him for his lifetime? Well, DSVP has moved up the chain, one link. We're about teaching fishing instructors. If you'd like to know more about what we are and what we do, there are partners throughout the room. They'd love to talk to you. There are sign-up sheets. Please leave some contact information and we'll reach out to you. Come and check us out. Engaged philanthropy is not only very effective, it's a lot of fun. Thank you. Good night. Drive safe.